ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Jack McLennan was 27, fit and visibly strong.
He was trained well. He knew how to hit, and I was gobsmacked.
He seemed ready for anything, but then he suddenly vanished.
I was just talking to him last night. Like, how the hell does that happen?
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. Damien Carrick with you. There's a wave of defamation suits from within the Trump administration targeting the US media. Most recently, FBI Chief Kash Patel sued The Atlantic magazine over an article that alleged heavy drinking, so severe that it's said to have created a national security risk.
You want to attack my character? Come at me. Bring it on. I'll see you in court.
There's also been a slew of defamation suits brought by President Donald Trump against leading news outlets, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal and the BBC.
I'm suing the BBC for putting words in my mouth, literally, they put words in my mouth.
There have also been actions against the media for alleged election interference and consumer fraud, and concerns that government agencies in charge of granting media licences have been weaponised by the Trump administration in attempts to make the media compliant or even settle weak defamation cases. Professor Ronald Anderson Jones is an expert in media and constitutional law at the University of Utah. Ronald, how would you describe the state of the freedom of press in the USA right now?
It's a complicated, complicated landscape for the press in the US at the moment. And I think that the defamation cases that you're describing are sort of one piece of a web of threats that journalists and press freedom organizations in the U.S. are worried about. There were lots of hints in the first Trump administration about the press falling into disfavor, lots of rhetorical flourish and vilification, enemy of the people and fake news and that kind of language. And we saw a real pivot in the second Trump administration from that kind of rhetorical attack to a more directed, targeted attacks of action. And defamation law is sort of one piece of that. And the kinds of anxiety that is happening within the sort of mainstream media in the U.S. is pretty significant, in part because the levers of control are happening from so many different directions.
And we'll talk about some of those levers of control in our conversation. Is this an unprecedented situation, or have previous U.S. presidents and senior administration figures also used defamation laws in this way and been generally hostile to the media in a way that you would describe the current administration?
Well, it is, of course, the case that all presidents have had tensions with the press. No governmental official enjoys the kind of scrutiny and demands for transparency that stand in the way of their political agendas. But the kinds of behaviors that we're seeing now are fully unprecedented. And in part, some of this is legal and some of it is a matter of norms. The major U.S. Supreme Court case on this question, New York Times versus Sullivan, sort of set the stage, and the Supreme Court envisioned that the dynamics in these situations would not be legal. That is, if, as sometimes happens, a high governmental official found themselves the target of a falsehood or something that was defamatory. The court said, you know, the way that we handle that in our system of self-government is primarily through counter speech. It's through you, the public official, taking to your many platforms and correcting the record, stating what is true, not bringing suits for cripplingly large amounts of damages against news organizations in ways that could have a chilling effect on the kind of robust dialogue we want to have on matters of public concern. So we really just did not see this. Sitting presidents did not sue in libel. They did not threaten to sue in libel, and they certainly didn't bring suits of the size and sort of staggering amounts of sought damages that we see in these cases. Many of these cases seek billions with a B dollars in damages, the sort of thing that would be truly ruinous for a news organization.
In that 1964 Supreme Court case, New York Times and Sullivan, the New York Times published a four-page advertisement from a civil rights group that contained several factual errors. And Alabama Police Commissioner L.B. Sullivan was ultimately unsuccessful in his defamation action. Before we talk about Donald Trump's defamation cases, some of them claiming billions of dollars in damages, the recent Kash Patel article in The Atlantic magazine, what does that article say?
The Atlantic published a piece that suggested that Patel, who is the head of the FBI, had a serious drinking problem and also that this drinking problem stood in the way of his performance of his duties in that post. It was, according to The Atlantic, deeply sourced. So The Atlantic claims that they spoke to a wide range of people, of former and current FBI officials, but also, hospitality workers at bars and hotels and members of Congress and lobbyists and law enforcement officials and people from intelligence agencies. They ran the piece, and Patel quite immediately sued for $250 million in libel, claiming that he was given a very short turnaround time to respond before it went to press, and using a lot of the rhetoric that we heard in the filing of other defamation suits by his boss, President Trump, about the fake news and the sort of agenda that the news media is said to have against him. The case is a complicated one, in part because, just like Donald Trump, Kash Patel will be held to our very strict constitutional standard in libel law. It is not enough for him to show that the material is false, although he would have to do so, and he would have to do so by clear and convincing evidence. But he would also have to show that the reporter and The Atlantic, the publication itself, knew that it was false. They acted with a subjective awareness of
malice.
The falsity. Yes. And the phrase that we use in the U.S. constitutional term is the actual malice standard. It's a bit of a misnomer because it actually doesn't mean either actual or malice. It doesn't have anything to do with the journalist's feelings or attitude towards the allegedly defamed individual. It has to do with the journalist's relationship with the truth. And so it's a very strange and also difficult standard to prove. You have to kind of climb inside the head of the reporter and demonstrate that when they published what they published, they did it knowing that it wasn't true, or at least with reckless disregard for the truth, which is itself a subjective standard, a high degree of awareness of the probable falsity. That standard is set deliberately high to achieve those constitutional self-government goals that we described. And it's meant to push most of the dialogue on matters of public concern into this back and forth in the public dialogue rather than into the courts on defamation. But it hasn't acted as a deterrent for Patel or for Trump in the bringing of these suits. And we now have this case pending in the District Court of the District of Columbia.
And do you think it's a strong case?
It is not a strong case. And this is sort of true across the board for any suit brought by a public official in the United States. By definition, those cases have such an incredibly high bar to clear on the showing of falsity and fault that they're not entirely unwinnable. It is, of course, the case that there could be internal evidence that is brought about in discovery and found in the course of litigation that would demonstrate the real kind of smoking gun that you almost have to have in order to prevail. But this would be the sort of thing of someone internally at a news organization saying out loud to someone else in the news organization, we know that this isn't true and we're moving ahead with it anyway. And that's the sort of thing that almost never is the case, and also is incredibly difficult to prove, even if it is. It seems deeply unlikely that the suit was brought to be won. These suits are very often brought for their own sort of public relations splash as an opportunity to kind of shape the public messaging and attempt to punish financially with the litigation costs these sort of dissident news organizations, and to sort of telegraph and message more broadly to other news organizations that might in the future want to engage in critical reporting that doing so might be perilous.
So it has a strategic value, you're saying, for the politicians to do this. Look, the Patel-Atlantic dispute comes just a month after a court in Florida dismissed a defamation suit brought by President Trump against the Wall Street Journal. What was the article that made the president so angry?
Yes, the Wall Street Journal published an article describing what it said was a lewd birthday greeting from President Trump that was included in a 50th birthday book for convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Trump, by his own account, phoned lots of folks at The Wall Street Journal, including Rupert Murdoch at the very top of the organization, the evening before, demanding that it not be run. And they moved forward with it. Ultimately, a congressional committee gathered and released this birthday book, which did contain a contribution that appeared to be from Trump or that matched the description of the one that The Wall Street Journal said was against Trump. He sued for defamation, sued The Wall Street Journal, key editors and reporters at The Wall Street Journal, again, having to show this very high standard. And the reason that the suit was dismissed was that the trial court judge said that he failed to adequately claim and plead that key element, the element of actual malice.
In dismissing the case, Judge Darren Gale said the $10 billion suit, that's U.S. dollars, fell, quote, nowhere close to plausibility in alleging that the Wall Street Journal knowingly published false information or recklessly disregarded the truth. There is, of course, also the $20 billion U.S. dollar case that Donald Trump is bringing against the BBC in U.S. courts for an episode of its Panorama program. It's a flagship TV current affairs program. It was broadcast in the UK in October 2024, just days before the U.S. presidential election, under the title Trump, A Second Chance. Now, among the many events the program focused on was the 2021 Capitol Hill riots. The BBC admitted that there were some problems with this broadcast. What were those problems? And do you think they satisfy the malice test that you've been describing?
Yeah, I mean, this case is a really good example of the quite wide gulf between what we might think of as questions of best practices in journalism versus questions of what is constitutionally punishable through tort law in the United States, given that overlay from New York Times versus Sullivan. The editing in question that is sort of the nub of the complaint is that the program took two separate statements that Trump made on January 6th before the attacks on the Capitol, two crowds that had gathered, one that was made near the beginning of his remarks and one that was made closer to the end of them with, you know, more than an hour in between the two, and juxtaposed them as if they had been adjacent in time. And Trump's allegation is that that juxtaposition created the false impression that he incited riotous illegal behavior at the Capitol. And the BBC internally experienced a significant amount of turmoil in the aftermath of this. Lots of folks lost their jobs, much reordering.
The BBC's Director General, Tim Davey, and its CEO of News, Deborah Turness, both stepped down as a result of this.
Yes. Yeah. So we do see a sort of one interesting question in defamation law is sort of the acknowledgement of error in the aftermath, whether that goes to knowledge of falsity or whether that contradicts knowledge of falsity, right? We saw our error, we apologized for it. We can see in hindsight that this sort of editing wasn't a good idea. We don't know what kind of background internal communications exist at the BBC, which would be, of course, key to proving up the kind of standard that Trump would have the burden of proving in a U.S. suit. The case is controversial in a wide variety of ways. It's controversial for the really almost monopoly money level damages being sought, right? Those sorts of dollars are sort of astronomically high, and particularly so in terms of trying to think about actual provable harm to reputation.
He
won the election, and resoundingly in Florida, which is where the suit is being brought. And there doesn't appear to be any meaningful evidence that that program was viewable in Florida. It isn't on BritBox, which is the program, the one kind of tool that we use in the U.S. to watch BBC programming. It wasn't streamed on the BBC website. So at a front level question, there were jurisdictional concerns that maybe this suit couldn't be brought at all. But there are still sort of trickle down concerns about whether, even if the suit can be brought, whether it's the sort of thing that he could sort of prove up the elements of. And the actual malice bar remains very, very high. But the point is that in between the filing of the suit and all of those snags along the way, are really immense legal fees, really significant amounts of discovery that sort of probe around the potentially the BBC's internal workings, potentially stumble upon material that is embarrassing or politically fraught for the BBC. So sometimes the motivations in these cases are, again, not to win the suit, but rather to cause the damage, using the suit as kind of a cudgel for some of those other steps that the organization would have to take. And it's for sure expanding the kind of outward messaging that Trump is making. Previously, the targets of these suits were all internal, domestic news organizations. This signals even to international news organizations that he might be litigious.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. I'm Damien Carrick. My guest today is Professor Ronald Anderson-Jones, a constitutional and defamation law expert at the University of Utah. She's a guest of the University of Sydney Law School, where she's been participating in a series of events, including a workshop titled Democracy, the Press, Politics and Power. Ronald, Donald Trump has had some success in defamation actions against the media. In December 2024, the American ABC network did agree to pay the president $15 million US to settle a defamation case after one of its presenters, George Stephanopoulos, in an interview with a Trump supporter, repeatedly described the president as having been found liable for rape by a New York judge in a civil case. What was that interview about? And in your view, did the president have a strong defamation case, or were there other factors influencing the network's decision to settle this case?
Well, I think as a starting matter, we can take as a given that there are always other factors influencing networks and news organizations in the U.S. to settle these cases. In this instance, the distinction was between making reference to rape and making reference to sexual assault, the latter of which he had been found liable for in a New York state court. But New York state law makes a distinction, a technical distinction between rape and sexual assault. And so by definition, on the sort of jury form, he had not been found liable for rape. And among the things that, of course, would have been litigated if it had gone further into the process before settling was sort of whether the colloquial meaning of the two melded enough that it was substantially true. At least one judge had chimed in that he thought that that was the case. And, of course, the wider defense that ABC would have invoked and that is very often successful in these cases is that Sullivan actual malice question, that even if it was factually false, the capacity of the plaintiff to demonstrate knowing falsity, that it happened as a sort of calculated, deliberate plan, is a very, very difficult hurdle to clear. Lots of scholars and commentators in the U.S. thought that ABC had a winnable case. But this happened on the cusp of the second Trump administration. Disney, the parent company of ABC, had a great deal of business in front of the administration in various corporate facets of its work. And the question of the politicization of defamation suits and the politicization of a wide variety of other previously less political, more independent governmental agencies are sort of coming together at this moment. So lots of news organizations that are housed within big corporations that have a great deal of business, and everyone, every big corporation in the United States is potentially touched by the Department of Justice and the Federal Communications Commission and tax audits and the question of the immigration status of their employees. And so the concerns about the potential for executive leverage kind of comes into these calculations in ways that lots of commentators in the U.S. assume is what's mostly driving the train in these settlements.
Because, Ronald, there was also a settlement of a case with CBS over a 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris. What was the broader context surrounding that settlement?
The CBS suit is one of a handful that we've seen in the U.S. that are not brought as defamation suits, but are essentially defamation claims wrapped up in other causes of action. Sometimes it's election interference claims. Here it was a consumer fraud claim under a Texas statute, the sort of statute that's really designed for, you know, shifty salespeople who misrepresent what they are offering for sale, and then it gives Texans a cause of action to be able to sue for having been duped into buying something that they wouldn't have purchased if they had fuller information. The case was brought in a Texas court in a district that has only one judge, such that the assignment of it would necessarily go to this judge, and this judge is a Trump appointee. It's actually a district that has become famous for the bringing of lots of kind of politically charged suits, a sort of targeted forum shopping. And at the time, the news coverage in the U.S. when the suit was filed said bringing this to challenge the editing of news organization's program, its decision of how much of a, you know, 20 or 30 second response from Kamala Harris it will ultimately decide to air in the course of its editing, is sort of so wholly unprecedented that it surely will be dismissed. And CBS surely will not prevail. There were lots of comments in the news from constitutional law scholars in the U.S. saying things like, this might border on being sanctionable from the attorneys who filed the suit. But CBS had significant business before the Trump administration, including a proposed sale that needed the administration's sign off. And the suit ultimately did settle for $16 million, just a very close cousin in number to the number that the ABC suit settled for. Lots of commentators from the corporate law world who are observing that think that that's not coincidence, that CBS may well have feared that it would experience lawsuits from its own shareholders for engaging in bribery if the number had been much higher. So they anchored it in a number that was a defamation suit settlement number that had already been established with another network in another defamation suit. But the concern here is the same, that these defamation suits aren't being brought to be won. They're being brought to extract settlements and to nudge news organizations into pivoting with a change of their approach and their coverage. And it does seem to be successful.
And then there are numerous other cases we could talk about, Trump and the New York Times in Florida, and Trump and the Pulitzer Prize Board, also largely can be described as defamation cases. In recent years, we have seen the US Supreme Court overturn its own decisions, most notably back in 2022 when the case of Dobbs and Jackson Women's Health Organization, the court overturned the 1974 Roe and Wade decision, which entrenched a woman's right to choose a termination. Could a conservative majority of the US Supreme Court overturn or water down the Sullivan 1964 Supreme Court decision that we've been talking about? It's kind of been underpinning our whole conversation about setting a very high bar for politicians or public figures to succeed in an action for defamation.
There definitely is a movement afoot to push for this, something that, you know, if you had posed the question to me a decade ago, I would have said it's unfathomable that Sullivan would be reconsidered or overturned. It's an anchor case in the press freedom space, but also really an anchor First Amendment doctrine, sort of speaking to the constitutional right to engage in dialogue in self-government, to be able to have conversations about those who govern us, and to be able to have robust and wide open conversations free of the concern of a chilling effect. The Supreme Court has been asked repeatedly in recent years to reconsider the case. Two justices of the court have indicated a willingness to do so. And it's difficult to know sort of what's going on behind the scenes, whether any movement is growing amongst them to take a case. And if they did take a case, whether there would be enough agreement, whether it be five votes on the court to reverse it. But we do stand at a moment in which the precedent has some cracks in it, and that there is at least some appetite for watering down the kinds of barriers that right now are the only thing stopping some of these high-ranking public officials from bringing these big suits.
So far, we've been talking about defamation. Government agencies in charge of granting media licenses, some argue, have been weaponized by the Trump administration in an attempt to make those media compliant and even to settle weak defamation cases. Last year, I think late night TV show host Jimmy Kimmel was taken off air by ABC America after the comedian made comments following the assassination of Charlie Kirk. What was the involvement of the head of the Federal Communications Commission, Brendan Carr, in the decision to cancel the program, in your view?
Yeah, we have a constitutional doctrine in the U.S. that is referred to as the jawboning doctrine. It's an old-timey term that roots to, I think, an Old Testament story about somebody, you know, slaying someone with nothing more than the jawbone of an ass. The idea that sort of very weak tools can bring about very hefty consequences, and that in the First Amendment context, it is as unconstitutional for the government to do via a third party what the government might do in terms of censorship directly. So in this setting, the allegation of jawboning was that Brendan Carr, who is the head of the FCC, went on a podcast and expressed concern about the kinds of jokes that Jimmy Kimmel was making and the disrespect that he thought Kimmel as a comedian was showing for the recently departed Charlie Kirk. And he said that he thought that the parent company, ABC, needed to take action against Jimmy Kimmel. And he said, and I think this is a direct quote, "We can do it the hard way or the easy way," suggesting they, ABC, can pull him down. But if they don't, we, the Federal Communications Commission, will have to come and take a heavy hand in ABC and its licensing. The major broadcast networks are not themselves directly regulated by the FCC, but all of the stations themselves.
Their affiliate, people who take their content.
That's right. Yeah. And in the wave of this, a bunch of affiliates responded in exactly the way that Brendan Carr telegraphed that they ought to, pulled Kimmel briefly until he was reinstated, in large part because of very significant public backlash. But there's been another round of this recently where we've seen Kimmel again sort of flare up public controversy and governmental officials speak in ways that were directly or indirectly threatening. And it's part and parcel of this wider theme that we're talking about, which is there are a series of potentially weak or challengeable, sort of winnable actions that are happening against press organizations and media companies. But the combined effect of them creates a pressure that almost makes the underlying law irrelevant. We have this widening gulf in the U.S. between, on the one hand, if you just looked at it on its face, sort of the constitutional protection, the statutory rights, the sort of protection that one has within their administrative law dealings with some of these agencies. The law is very hefty, robustly in favor of press freedom, very supportive of a lot of the actions that the media organizations are taking. But the gulf between that and the boots on the ground reality, the operational freedom that the media organizations feel, is quite wide. And it's in part because of that gulf that domestic and international press freedom rankings in the U.S. are plummeting, not because we don't have really strong constitutional and statutory protection, but because they aren't necessarily invocable in ways that have operational benefit.
In conclusion, Ronald, how optimistic are you that the US can move forward in a way that protects freedom of speech?
It's a hard prognosis to make, in part because we are still very much at the early stages of a lot of these cases. And when we think about what the law provides and the protection constitutionally and statutorily that these independent journalistic outlets enjoy, that's a source of fairly significant hope. I'm less hopeful about the wider capacity that we are now seeing for executive lawfare and leverage. The diagnosis, I think, here is much wider than concerns about defamation law. It's concerns about separation of powers. It's concerns about the neutrality of courts. It's concerns about the politicization of previously independent agencies and departments. It's this web of issues that I think we all have to keep our eye on.
Professor Ronald Anderson-Jones, an expert in media and constitutional law at the University of Utah, thank you. Thank you for speaking to The Law Report.
Thanks for having me.
That's all we've got time for this week. Do follow The Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thank you to producer Christina Cucoglia and to audio producer Elise Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.